From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Tanya Mosley. It's Here and Now. The Trump campaign is filing a partial recount in Wisconsin, in heavily Democratic Milwaukee and Dane counties. But a recount is unlikely to change results in the state, which Biden won by more than 20,000 votes. The move comes as the Trump campaign's efforts to contest election results have failed in numerous courtrooms.
And as there was a failed move to discount votes in Michigan, last night, two Republican members of an elections board in Wayne County, which includes Detroit, refused to certify the vote, citing discrepancies, then backtracked after an outcry from local residents and national observers, as well as Michigan's Democratic Secretary of State, who called those discrepancies minor clerical errors. Meanwhile, there's more reaction to President Trump's firing by tweet of Chris Krebs, one of the country's top election security officials, who declared the elections the most secure in U.S. history. Miles Parks covers election security for NPR. He's here. And Miles, in Michigan, as I said, there were these fiery public comments reacting to these attempts by two Republicans on the Wayne County Board of Canvassers to block certification of the vote. Here's Michigan resident Ginny Von Corder.
I'm a sixth-generation Michigander, and it is my house you have trashed today. This is a shameful moment in our history. Until this meeting ends, a motion to reconsider your previous action would be important. But Ms. Parker or Mr. Hartman would need to grow a soul to summon the moral courage to make that motion.
Mentioning those two Republican board members who did backtrack in the end, but not until agreeing to an audit of the vote tally. Now, Miles, the concern is that there's a broad Republican strategy here of kicking contested election results to a Republican legislature, which then could appoint the electors for Trump, in effect discounting the vote of the people. Tell us more about this.
Yeah, that's the narrative coming from the president's people around the president's campaign, that the hope is they can delay certifications in enough of these swing states to get around the fact that Trump lost in these states. You know, in Michigan, he lost to Joe Biden by more than 140,000 votes. But there's no basis for this in reality. I want to be clear. I can't find a legal expert or an elections expert who thinks this is even a remote possibility. In the Michigan case, had the local board here not agreed to certify it, as you mentioned, in a couple hours after, you know, saying they wouldn't do it, they ended up doing it. Had they not done that, it would have gone to the state board, who would have then certified the results. And the highest ranking Republican in the state Senate in Michigan was asked about this yesterday, and he said that this sort of plan was, quote, not going to happen. So it is fair to say at this point that this is not going to happen. The bigger worry, though, when I talk to elections expert, is that every bureaucratic development like this, when the Trump campaign jumps in and celebrates it and messages it to supporters falsely as a sign of fraud, more and more people see these little developments as a sign of some reason to doubt the legitimacy of the process.
Yeah. Well, and what do we know about the recount that Tanya mentioned in Wisconsin?
So the Trump campaign is asking for a partial recount in just two counties in Wisconsin, Milwaukee and Dane, which encompasses Madison. It's important to think about this recount, too, though, through the lens of this sort of narrative shifting coming from the Trump campaign. Recounts never shift races by the amount Trump is down in Wisconsin, roughly 20,000 votes. So by asking for a recount in these isolated cities, he's able to continue to push this idea that urban voting districts are somehow not to be trusted without having to pay for a full recount. Because in Wisconsin, when the margins are this big, if a candidate wants a recount, they have to pay for it themselves. This partial recount will cost the Trump campaign around $3 million. A full recount would have cost a lot more.
And we only have a minute here, but Chris Krebs, the director of the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency at the Department of Homeland Security, who had said that the 2020 election was the most secure ever, was fired by President Trump. What are you hearing? What's reaction to that?
Yeah, I mean, it's been the same sort of reaction from Republicans in Trump's orbit, you know, continuing to push these conspiracy theories. People inside the Department of Homeland Security are pretty concerned about, you know, what this means for the next couple weeks and months. You know, morale in the agency is definitely something to watch, and we'll be looking to see whether the department keeps up this rumor control website that they had been doing under Krebs that was fact-checking a lot of claims that were coming from the president and from other misinformation sources. We'll be watching whether they continue doing that now that Krebs is gone.
Yeah, and Miles Parks is watching all of it. He covers election security for NPR. Miles, thanks so much.
Thanks, Robin.
Following similar moves in Massachusetts and Ohio, the state of California is now floating the idea of a curfew to slow the spread of the coronavirus. The majority of California's counties are now under the state's highest level of COVID-19 restrictions, which means some businesses have had to scale back operations, including restaurants, which are no longer allowed to offer indoor dining. And this comes at a time when cases are surging and when hopes for financial relief from Congress is growing dimmer. And that worries our next guest. Jerry Fatt is president of the Fatt Family Restaurant Group in Sacramento, California. Jerry, welcome to the show.
Yes, thank you.
Jerry, for those who are listening, your family is well known in Sacramento. You own three restaurants there. The original location is an upscale Chinese restaurant called Frank Fatt's that your dad founded 81 years ago after immigrating from China. It is a popular place for politicians there in the state's capital. How much has the pandemic impacted your bottom line?
Oh, very much significantly. With the restrictions, our revenues are down about 60% from pre-COVID times.
Down 60%. How many employees have you had to lay off?
At least two-thirds. When we were, again, pre-COVID times, between all our three restaurants, we have nearly 300 employees. So we are down to about 120.
This mandate obviously hurts you and businesses like yours. You also had to close during the spring when the pandemic first began, but at that point you actually had financial support through stimulus relief. Can you compare the support you had then and how you weathered the storm compared to the support you have now?
Yes, we were fortunate to get a PPP loan. Of course, 6 months later, we've had multiple surges. We've been open, we've been closed. We think it's unfair to small businesses such as us, not just the restaurant industry, when big businesses such as Costco, Home Depot, and Walmart are able to let hundreds of people in per day, where most restaurants, we are fortunate to get 100 customers per day.
I understand what you're saying about places like Walmart and Home Depot. There have been studies, though. There's a Stanford study that found most COVID-19 transmissions occur at super spreader sites, at cafes and fitness centers and gyms and restaurants. So these closures are happening for the benefit of public health. But there is this problem with business owners who are just trying to stay afloat. We see that restaurant owners in Oregon have gotten together to make a plea to Governor Kate Brown asking for financial assistance to stay afloat, COVID-19 testing. What would you like to see happen in the state of California?
What I'd like to see in the state of California is reduce some of our regulations. Another outstanding issue coming up is we have asked the governor to delay our minimum wage hike that is coming due on January 1st. And we're not against the safety protocols, you know, for restaurants for COVID. Mm-hmm. Just we would like some compromise to be able to survive during this hard times.
You actually have brought back many employees just recently. This latest call to restrict indoor dining, what does this mean for those employees who have come back?
Yes, not very stable for them. October, we were able to open our restaurants anywhere from 25 to 50% dine-in. So we just recently hired a slew of employees to come back. But unfortunately, 2-3 weeks later, we had to lay off all those employees that we just recently hired back. And I feel bad for them because they're looking for stability, too.
I can imagine how much pressure and weight this is on you as a business owner, because the livelihoods of so many of your employees depend on you.
Yes. You know, being around for 81 years, we have a lot of long-term employees. We've seen many employees grow up in our business and get married, have children, et cetera. So they become part of our family, the Fatt family.
Under these new rules, what do you see as the future of your restaurants, which, as I mentioned, bear your family's name?
Assuming the vaccine news is good, that it's coming soon, we are just, like many restaurants, trying to get to that point. We're not even trying to be profitable. So I think we're going to be able to weather the storm, but it would be a lot easier if we could get some type of stimulus package from the federal government to help businesses and our employees to make the anxiety a little less.
Jerry Fatt is president of the Fatt Family Restaurant Group in Sacramento, California. Thank you for sharing your story with us, Jerry, and my best to you.
Thank you, Tanya.
Georgia election official Gabriel Sterling says his state is on track to wrap up a full hand count of audit of all votes cast in the 2020 election by tonight's midnight deadline. Sterling, who is a Republican, told CNN today that he has not found the kind of widespread fraud that President Trump claims cost him the election.
There were always going to be some illegal votes, and we're trying to track those down and investigate them. But there's nothing to say the outcome will be different based on what we're seeing so far through this audit.
In January, voters in Georgia will go back to the polls for two runoff elections that will determine which party controls the U.S. Senate. And we've got two political strategists who are based in Georgia with us to talk about all of this. Janelle King is a Republican strategist. Welcome to the show, Janelle.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
And Robert Patillo is a Democratic strategist. Hey, Robert.
Hey, thank you so much for having me also.
Yes, let's start with you, Janelle, and let's talk about President Trump first. He's fighting Republican election officials in your state over the vote count. Is there a rift in the Georgia Republican Party over who to follow and who to believe? And is that a long-term problem for your party?
Well, I wouldn't say that the president is fighting Republican officials in the state. I will say that he's fighting in general for an election that has some questionable outcomes. But I think it's fair to say that both parties are in a very unique time. You know, you have the Dems that have the inner discussions as to whether they're going to go super progressive or try to maintain the moderate stance. But however, you know, shaking things up a bit, it only opens doors for new ideas and new strategies. And one thing I can definitely assure you is that in Georgia, even though there may be discussions around the presidential race, I know that as Republicans, we are 100% unified regarding the Senate race.
Okay, 100% unified regarding the Senate race, but the president is pushing regarding this vote count. Georgia has to certify its results by 5 p.m. Friday. Do either of you expect to see the kind of thing that happened in Wayne County, Michigan last night when Republican election commissioners initially refused to certify the vote?
And I mean, Janelle, it's 2020. I'll start. Okay. you know what? It's 2020. I don't think I at this point, I don't expect anything. I am just going to wait and see what happens. I definitely believe that, and I know that there are a number of people who are concerned as to whether or not, you know, this election exemplified the highest level of integrity. But, you know, I have no clue what's going to happen.
Robert.
Yeah, I don't think there'll be any controversy. I think when people have to understand just how Republican Georgia is as a state. Georgia's not elected a Democrat over, statewide in over a decade. They have a constitutional majority in the House. They have a majority in the Senate. They control every single statewide elected office in the state. You do not have a redder state for as far as political control than Georgia. And the fact that they are having this civil war where you have the two senators trying to demand the resignation of the Republican Secretary of State, I think you're seeing a rift between your traditional Southern conservative Republicans and the Trumplicans, whose allegiance lies with President Trump above party, above Constitution, above the will of the people of Georgia. We keep saying that this was a close election, but the margins in this election are staggering. We're talking about Joe Biden has 306 electoral votes nationwide. He's leading by 6 million votes in the popular vote. In order for President Trump somehow to, as they say, overturn this election, he would need to win Alaska, Georgia, North Carolina, Pennsylvania, and then Joe Biden would still win 270 to 268. And so then he would have to flip another state along the lines of Arizona, Nevada, Michigan, or Wisconsin in order for this to happen. So if President Trump thinks that our voting system is so broken that he won this election, then it's time for a constitutional convention to to redo our entire voting system. That's the nature of what he's trying to argue for. And so the majority of the people in the state of Georgia have moved on to discussion on the two Senate seats, which are going to decide the future of the United States of America and the balance of power in the United States Senate.
Absolutely. It's what we're talking about and why we're talking about this with you both today. It's interesting what you're saying, though, about Georgia being a red state and the rift really being Trumpers versus other folks in the Republican Party who are not Trump supporters. But do you think that there will be an effect, Trump's unfounded claims of fraud? How will that turn or affect the upcoming runoffs? Are voters discouraged to vote? Are they energized? I mean, Trump will not be on the ballot in January. Will these hardcore Trump voters that you talk about show up?
Well, I think President Trump is only hurting the Republicans in Georgia right now. Let's understand, there was an interview with our Secretary of State yesterday where he said there were 24,000 Republicans who voted absentee during the primary who did not vote absentee during the general election. So in his calculation, President Trump would have won the state by 10,000 votes if he hadn't spent 6 months telling people that that absentee voting and mail-in voting was a fraud. And so what he's doing right now by tearing down our governor, by tearing down our Secretary of State, tearing down our county level elections officials, giving the Republican base no belief that our election is going to be free and fair and that the will of the people will be the outcome, is depressing Republican voter turnout. At the same time, the Democrats are coming in from all around the country. The cavalry is riding in. We're having people come in from California and New York and Illinois and all across the country to campaign and to hit the ground in Georgia because we understand how important this election is. So it's two parties going in vastly different directions.
Well, let's break down one of the runoff elections. Republican Senator Kelly Loeffler is running against Reverend Raphael Warnock. Here's Loeffler on Fox News on Monday night.
Liberals are supporting the most radically liberal candidate in the country for Senate today in Raphael Warnock, and I'm going to expose that. And look, it's
Warnock is the pastor of Martin Luther King Jr.'s church in Atlanta. A Fox 5 poll yesterday said that it's a dead heat. Janelle, how much of a risk is it for Loeffler to go negative on Warnock?
Well, I don't think it's a risk to go negative. I don't even see it as going negative. I see it as her stating the obvious and stating the truth. You know, Raphael Warnock can post as many commercials as he would like with puppies and showing a side of him that many people don't know. What I see is the messaging that comes from him, and it does seem a bit radical. I mean, he criticized the president's decision to move the embassy to Jerusalem. He criticized our police officers by calling them thugs. He also said that you can't be a believer and love God and be in the military, when I know plenty of people, including my husband, who are veterans and who are in the military, who wouldn't have gotten through without God. So I think that when you have comments that are made like that, it's extremely, extremely radical. And that's what she's calling out. One thing I know about Senator Loeffler is that her platform is very, very clear. The American dream for everyone. And that is what she wants to push, is to make sure that we all have access to economic success and being able to live in a country where our constitutional rights are preserved and not taken from us.
Robert, do you agree with this characterization of Warnock being a radical?
I've been a member of Ebenezer Baptist Church since I came back from law school in 2009, when I moved back to Atlanta. Pastor Warnock has expanded his ministry to deal with the homeless population in Atlanta, to deal with addiction issues in the city. He has a brother who went to prison for years, and he's devoted his ministry towards reentry programs for people who have been formerly incarcerated. What Republicans have decided to do is, since they can't run against Raphael Warnock, is to make up a version of Raphael Warnock to run against, which is antithetical to the reality on the ground. And I think that Kelly Loeffler attacking the black church, attacking Pastor Warnock and his faith, attacking Jeremiah Wright and his faith, attacking many of the titans of the black church, is not a good idea in the South, in the Bible Belt, for this campaign. And to try to compare character and resumes between a Southern Baptist minister and someone who has been a billionaire their entire life, one of the richest senators that we have in this country, who cashed in on the coronavirus pandemic, the people of Georgia see through this. And that's why Pastor Warnock, in a race of 20 20 plus people during the jungle primary, came out with 33% of the vote. And I think that's why the people of Georgia are flocking to him. You can't have two incumbent billionaire senators as Georgia has right now, and not expect the people of the state, which is going through economic turmoil, where small businesses are dying, and where our Senate did nothing to push through more stimulus money. The idea of attacking Pastor Warnock as being some kind of radical, I think, is because they have nothing else to talk about.
You know what? There's another runoff, and that
it's okay.
Yes, and we just have a minute 30 with you, so I want to ask you a big picture about the Senate coming up next year. But please respond really quickly.
Yeah, I have to say something about that. So I mean, Robert's emotional explanation as to why Pastor Warnock is the best option is simply that emotional. There's nothing in that speaks to anyone's day-to-day lives. And to say that she's attacking the Black church, I don't understand why we have to put Black in front of it. And then to shame her for being successful and having wealth is also another issue that I have with the Democratic Party. I think we need to make sure that we keep the main thing. She's not saying anything that Raphael Warnock hasn't said out of his own mouth. So I don't think there's anything wrong with her speaking on that.
So we also have the runoff between Republican Senator David Perdue and Democrat John Ossoff. And your predictions for who will control the Senate next year, very quickly, 30 seconds.
Well, Senator Perdue, he's already won.
I think Democrats are more energized. We're not fighting against our own during this weird civil war. We are fighting for facts, reality, and science. And that's why I think both Ossoff and Pastor Warnock will win.
Robert Petillo is a Democratic strategist. Janelle King is a Republican strategist. Thank you both for joining us.
Support for this podcast comes from the Boston Foundation. For more than a century, a resilient city and region have relied on the Boston Foundation to bring people together to solve our most serious problems. The Foundation's work has been strengthened by hundreds of people who've left legacies to support our community. Leaving a charitable legacy at the Boston Foundation is a great way to have an impact now and in the future. Learn more at tbf.org/partner.
The Boeing 737 MAX is ready for takeoff after the Federal Aviation Administration recertified the aircraft today. It was out of commission for 20 months following two fatal crashes. But with the pandemic keeping air travel at record lows, airlines may not be in a rush to get the 737 back in the sky. Let's bring in Here and Now transportation analyst Seth Kaplan. Hey, Seth.
Hey, Tanya.
So the 737 MAX was grounded after Boeing fixed problems with the plane's flight control system. When can we expect U.S. airlines to begin flying these jets again?
Sometime next year. They now have to go through their own processes. And look, they can afford to be even more methodical than before. Not that they ever would have rushed the plane back into the air, but before COVID, they really wanted these planes. They were short aircraft in the case of some of these airlines, whereas now they very much aren't. They all have a glut of aircraft, and so there's just not as much of a rush, although these are the most efficient aircraft in their fleets in many cases. That's the reason they wanted them in the first place, and they're going to want to get them back up in the air as soon as they're convinced it's safe to do so.
Yeah. And then, as I mentioned, the pandemic has forced many airlines to reduce flights. But Southwest has actually expanded into new cities like Palm Springs, California, Sarasota, Florida. How are they able to grow in a time of such turmoil for airlines?
They're basically spreading themselves more thinly. They're not really growing by the most basic measures of the size of an airline. So in terms of the numbers of flights or seats or passengers that they're carrying, they're not growing in those regards. They're flying a lot less in some places and a little bit more in others. Southwest, historically, an airline that flew to maybe surprisingly few cities, you could say, relative to how big of an airline it was. It offered very frequent service in between places like Houston and Dallas, key markets like that, but only about 100 cities, which actually isn't very much for an airline that's as big as Southwest is in other ways. Now, doing a little bit more like what some other airlines do, fly to more places, but not as frequently in the same markets.
Mm-hmm. Something else I want to ask you about. Earlier this week, United Airlines began testing all passengers on flights from Newark to London for the coronavirus. How does this program work?
Yeah, and this is a pilot program, as you said. These are the rapid COVID tests, rather accurate, although not as accurate as the tests that take longer to come back. But generally speaking, you get the test result back very quickly. And United is calculating here, because it's accepting the cost of doing all this, that that cost is less than the cost of what it's dealing with more broadly, which is people not traveling because they're afraid to travel, whether it's because they're afraid of what's actually going to happen on the airplane, or just that they don't want to deal with what's going to happen at the destination, or all of the other reasons that people are just sort of avoiding moving around right now. So United thinks this could help people give some of that, regain some of that confidence they've lost.
Any other major airlines expected to follow suit on this idea?
It's something that's clearly of interest to a lot of them, to varying degrees around the world. Different airlines have either started pilots like United in some countries, or at least expressed interest. Always a question of cost. The global industry, the global association that represents the airlines, IATA, likes this kind of thing, but just thinks that governments should be the ones footing more of the bill.
That's Here and Now transportation analyst Seth Kaplan. As always, thank you.
Thank you, Tanya.
Let's take a break from the headlines, shall we? With pie. Black bottom peanut butter cloud pie, very fig and walnut pie, butterscotch nut custard pie. Let's go to Pie Academy with Ken Heydrich, who had us in the opening lines of his new Pie Academy cookbook with "Your dough cracks and falls apart. It sticks to your counter like super glue. Your pies are too ugly to bring out in public. I feel your pain. You've come to the right place. I can help." Oh, Ken Heydrich, where were you last Thanksgiving? But food writer and cookbook author Ken Heydrich is here now. His new book includes 255 different fillings, gluten-free dough, instructions on mailing. Ken Heydrich, welcome.
Hi, Robin. How are you? Thanks for having me.
Well, you're here in the nick of time. And let's just get right to it. Let's say hypothetically, either, you know, maybe a friend of mine sometimes uses that dough that's in the refrigerator section of the store. It's pre-made, or you can get it frozen in a tin in the freezer. If you buy that, what are you missing in not making your own?
Now, you're asking for a friend, right?
Yes.
Yes.
Hypothetically.
I try not to be critical of anybody's choices when it comes to pie. So if you choose, or your friends choose, to use a different type of crust, that's fine. However, you're missing the fun of making your own pie crust. You know, to get your hands down into those raw ingredients, that cool butter and that flour, and to cut those ingredients together, I mean, that's really good, simple fun, and I love doing it. And then there's the flavor, because if you're starting with good fresh ingredients, your flour, your butter, a packaged crust is never going to taste as good as that.
Okay, well, give us the best tips for what to do with it, because it does sometimes end up gooey in your hands or stuck to your counter. You know, let's say that the fat we're going to use is butter in a crust, and you say you cut it into cubes. We know that. This is before we're going to cut it into the dry ingredients, the flour. And you say dust those cubes in flour.
I do a couple of things. I actually dust the plate where I'm going to put the cubes of butter, and then I like to toss the butter in the flour, because you know how butter gets when you start handling it. It gets a little sticky and gummy. It just keeps your hands from getting all gummy real quick.
Then we know we need to work quickly with dough that's been chilled. When you're cutting the fat in, how else do you keep it from just getting too gooey?
Well, at any point, you know, and this is a very common thing, especially if somebody is a new pie maker, either when they're cutting in the fat or when they start to roll it, it does start to, you know, warm up. It is butter after all, and the more you handle it, the more it's going to start to loosen up. But at any point, you got to remember, you can take that whole bowl along with your dough cutter and stick the whole thing right in the refrigerator, and that'll give you time to chill. Literally and figuratively, and then go back to it.
Rolling it out, you say, do it on wax paper, and then use the wax paper to carry what you've rolled out over to put in the pie plate. But also, you have a mixing fork?
It looks like a big fork that you'd use when you're carving a turkey or something like that. And it has just the right spacing between the tines and just the right sort of arch or curve to the tines. I think King Arthur Flour sells one. It's just a nice tool to have when you're making dough by hand.
Okay. Well, you have 23 different kinds of crusts. There's pretzel crust, Oreo crust, a cottage cheese pie dough. But if you just want to make some apple pies and maybe some, you know, pecan pies, pumpkin pie for Thanksgiving, what's the best crust?
Yeah, right at the front of the crust section, there's how to make a perfect pie dough by hand, and that's where I would start. There's two very basic crusts up front. One is making it in the food processor, and one is making it by hand. Knowing that this is the thing that really trips people up the most, we have a pretty extensive section, an extended tutorial at the front of the book about how to cut the ingredients in, how to handle the dough, how to roll it and get it in the pan. So, you know, start with one of those basic crusts.
Right, and it just is, it seems like flour, butter, water, you know, pretty basic. Okay, so let's move to the pies. We listed, I mean, there's just an amazing amount. But let's just say you're doing a fruit pie. Tips, fresh or frozen, unripe fruit or ripe, what do you suggest?
Well, this time of year, you know, everyone wants to know what type of apple is the best type of apple to use. I always say don't worry too much about what type of apple, as long as you don't use Red Delicious, which really doesn't live up to its name. You know, Galas, Fuji, things like that. Definitely use fresh fruit. And one of the things I love to do with my fall fruit pies is add pears to them. Pears adds this beautiful floral, flavor to them and aroma. And for Thanksgiving pie, I'm liable to throw in some cranberries, too. That adds nice tartness and color. In the winter, I like to use frozen fruit, like if I want a berry pie. Definitely use, you know, frozen blueberries or something like that. But this time of year, fresh fall fruit, the later it gets, I like to use frozen fruit in my winter pies.
What is blind baking, and when do you use that?
Blind baking refers to a process where you actually pre-bake the crust for a little bit. And you do this because oftentimes you have like a moist filling, like a custard filling or even a pumpkin pie filling. If you put that into a raw, fully uncooked dough, it's going to saturate. The dough is going to come out wet. So you do this process called blind baking, where you actually partially pre-bake the crust and helps prevent against that soggy crust syndrome.
I've done that with savory pies, but I didn't know that's what it was called. And you fill that crust that you're baking with like beans or something to weigh it down and bake it just a little bit. What about venting, either on the top or pricking holes in the bottom of a pie crust?
Yeah, the venting in the top crust is pretty important. And the main purpose of that is to just let off a little steam so the crust doesn't split around the side seam. But also, when I make vents in the top of the pie, I like to put several right next to the edge. And the reason I do that is I like to check the juices there later. After about 45 minutes to an hour, you should be able to see thick juices coming up through that hole. That means your thickener has worked and the pie filling is done.
And how about when you're baking? Do you find, too, as my friend does, that the fluted edges of the pie, they get so brown. I mean, do you aluminum foil them earlier in the process so that they don't cook as fast?
You can buy these little gadgets that'll help protect that edge like that, or you can take these little foil strips and connect them and use that to cover that part of your pie. I never worry too much about it because in the grand scheme of things, that's probably only about 5 or 10% of your pie real estate. So it's not something to get too concerned about.
Yeah. And this time of year, I think it's just such great advice. You talk about mailing pies. With so many of us aren't going to be able to see people who expect that, you know, walnut pie or whatever. So how do you mail it?
Well, first of all, you have to decide, should you mail it? And you know, if you're talking about your double crust apple pie or something like that, it's hardly worth mailing because after 2-3 days wrapped in plastic and that sort of thing, the top crust isn't going to be very great, and the pie is past its prime. So you have to start by picking the right type of pies, and that usually the more durable ones like the pecan pie. That's really a great one to ship. Obviously, you don't want to send a creamy pie like that because those won't hold up. Say you want to ship your pecan pie or pecan pie, you put it in the freezer the night before. You take it out of there, really wrap it up good in plastic wrap, and then get a big box with lots of padding on all sides. And that pie should arrive in good shape.
And by the way, you know, pies, Have you seen the Broadway show Waitress, in which pies are elevated to almost a religious item?
Yeah, I know about it. No, but I haven't had the opportunity to see it yet.
Well, do you agree? I mean, there's something about not just making pies, but thinking of different ways you can make pies, which you do here, the many different things you can do.
Well, you know, the thing about pie is it goes beyond religion. It goes beyond politics. It doesn't matter where you worship, who you live with, or anything else. You know, pie brings people together. Pie is poetry that makes the world a better place, I like to say. You put a pie in the middle of a table, and all of a sudden, people's differences fall away. It's just magic.
Well, Ken Heydrich, we have to say you have the highest recommendation. We see right here the endorsement on the back of the book from Here and Now resident chef Kathy Gunst, who says,
yes,
roll up your sleeves, roll out the dough, get baking. You're in good hands with Pie Academy. Ken Heydrich, that's the name of the book, Pie Academy. Master the perfect crust in 255 amazing fillings with fruits, nuts, creams, custards, ice cream, and more. Ken, thank you so much.
Thank you, Robin. I really appreciate it.
Even without a pandemic, foster parents have a tough job. Now, some foster parents in Massachusetts, faced with the added work of home, schooling, navigating visitation, and securing personal protective equipment, are trying to form what would be the nation's first union for foster parents. Deborah Becker of member station WBUR reports.
Whoa, it's the same. Is it the same?
Felicia and Rick LeClaire's faces light up while playing with their 22-month-old foster son. The toddler, who we're not identifying because his custody case is in court, has been living with the LeClaires in their Leominster, Massachusetts home since he was 5 days old. Felicia says he's the third child of a woman struggling with mental health and substance use issues who already had what's called an open case with state child welfare officials about another one of her children.
If there's already an open case, there's plus a positive substance exposure, that baby's removed. So he came to us and he's been here ever since.
The LeClaires, both with grown children and grandchildren of their own, became foster parents almost 5 years ago when they learned about a desperate need for care. Since then, they've taken in about 50 kids.
That's saying it takes a village. There are people that aren't able to take care of their children, and it doesn't matter why. The children are the bottom line, and how do we expect them to grow into successful, productive adults if we can't give them those tools that they need from the start?
The LeClaires think there should be a village, so to speak, of foster parents. So they're helping start a union with the more than 2,000 foster parents in Massachusetts. Although the idea has been discussed for more than a year, they say the pandemic has put more demands on foster families, such as getting PPE from the state and navigating visitation and education.
You weren't allowed to homeschool as a foster parent before. Now, lots of foster parents are homeschooling. It's a whole learning curve. It's a whole parenting curve. I'm a pediatric nurse. I was a member of a nursing union, so I know the benefits of having people on your team.
Having a union advocate for foster parents and help them deal with state bureaucracy would be another benefit, Rick LeClaire says, especially when navigating myriad regulations and state laws.
There's an unbelievable amount of red tape, bureaucracy, politics involved, and the people that are foster parents are all fragmented.
In a statement in response to the unionizing effort, the Massachusetts Department of Children and Families says it deeply values the work of foster parents, especially during the pandemic. It says it's improved training and communication and increased daily stipends and clothing allowances. But union supporters say money is just one issue. Cheryl Haddad, founding member and former president of the Massachusetts Alliance for Foster Families, says unionizing would help with some of what she does now, gathering foster families together to ask lawmakers for resources.
I find it very unreasonable to ask these volunteers who help take care of children to have to go to the legislature and ask them for those kinds of services. It's crazy.
But current Alliance President Catherine Tarraga questions whether a union is the way to go. She says foster parenting is more calling than career, and formalizing work arrangements could get in the way of family relationships.
I didn't become a foster parent to get a job. I became a foster parent to help children. So I don't see how it can be one and the same. I've had jobs where I was an employee, and that's not how I approach being a foster parent. This is very different approaches.
The Service Employees International Union, Local 509, is now holding meetings to gauge the level of support among foster parents. Union President Peter McKinnon says collective bargaining would be different for non-traditional workers like foster parents. He points to his union organizing daycare providers in Massachusetts, who also have complex individual situations that aren't easily covered in a labor agreement.
These are people who are doing a job. They are workers who need a voice to be able to do that work as effectively as possible, and we can give them that voice.
If they do get that voice, Massachusetts would be the first state with unionized foster parents. In Washington state, foster parents abandoned a unionizing effort more than a decade ago. Instead, they agreed to create a more formal structure to work with the state. Mary McGoy with the Foster Parents Association of Washington State says that hasn't worked out so well, so the idea of unionizing has resurfaced.
We'd certainly entertain that thought again. I don't think there's a single board member that wouldn't entertain that thought again.
The LeClaires say they understand, probably more than they first realized, that being a foster parent is more than a job. They learned in July that their foster son is eligible for adoption, so they filed the paperwork to do that.
It's a very complex dynamic that happens that you can't really predict. How can you take that kid after 22 months and put him with another family and say, okay, now we're not your mama and dad anymore. These people are. How do you do that to like a 2-year-old kid?
Legislation will be filed in Massachusetts in January to change state law and allow foster parents to collectively bargain with the state. For Here and Now, I'm Deborah Becker.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.